Welcome to the Big Drink Rethink podcast with me, your host, Anna Donaghy. If you've noticed that the drinking culture in the UK is changing and you're curious about why and what this means to your world, then this is the podcast for you. Throughout this series, I will be chatting with the thought-provoking, forward-thinking people at the heart of this shift to find out what makes them tick and to explore the sober curious perspective from all angles. And I'll also be giving you oodles of personal tools and tactics to help you get on board the Big Drink Rethink. Hello, and this promises to be a great episode because today I am welcoming Anita Clear onto the show. Anita is a parenting speaker, writer, and coach, and she's been doing all of that for about 18 years, before which she worked for a local authority children's service, where she managed specialist family support services like Sure Start centres, parent helplines, teenage pregnancy prevention projects, and intensive family support services. Her academic background is in developmental psychology, and she helps parents step back and reflect on parent-child dynamics. She founded the Positive Parenting Project in 2012 with the aim of helping parents cut through the fads and fashions of parenting advice and focus on evidence-based approaches that really do work. And the one thing I'm at pains to point out is she has a brilliant blog called Thinking Parenting. And this has been listed in the Sunday Times magazine as a must-read, but I can vouch for it. It is great. And she's also an author. Her book, The Work Parent Switch, outlines exactly how working parents can use those bits of time left over to help parents smartly. And her second book, How to Get Your Teenager Out of Their Bedroom, comes out in the UK in September. Gosh, it's a lot of stuff going on there. Anita, welcome to the show. Thank you for coming along.
Oh, thanks, Anna. Nice to be here.
Let's get straight into this, because I think this is going to be a bit of a sort of chock-a-blocker conversation, really. I know it's going to be very much about alcohol and kids, but clearly this is very much about how we best parent around this subject as well. I am in the eye of this particular storm, so as to speak. I have two daughters, 13 and 16, and I'm therefore going to find this very, very interesting myself. But there are some really common questions that I get asked, which I really just would love to have your perspective on. The first of which, I mean, we can talk through these in whatever order, but the first of which is how do you talk to your kids about alcohol? You know, that's a big question. One, again, which is very, very common, is how liberal should we be? This is a biggie, you know, when and how to introduce it. And this is that whole debate, obviously, around early intro to take the kind of forbidden allure away, or is an early intro just encouragement? And, you know, we'll get there. I know we'll talk through that. And then also, I guess this is sort of when things go a bit wrong, how to deal with, you know, the rebellious, problematic teenager who you think has possibly taken a wrong turn and gone down that route. I am very conscious that I'm doing all the talking. I do want to just put a few more things out there before we dig in, because there are some facts which I want to put out there, not to sort of scare, but maybe just sort of explain why this is such an important conversation. It is obvious that teenagers in general are interested in alcohol. That's kind of a general fact of life. I think possibly what a lot of people may not necessarily know the sort of statistics behind is just how many teens start drinking around the age of 14 or 15, and then more heavily at about the age of 16 onwards. So we know, we hear a lot about the fact that the younger generation are drinking less, but a lot of those surveys are reported between sort of 18 and 24 year olds. That's considered to be the younger generation. And that omits the age group that we're really talking about here. And in the latest study that I could find from the World Health Organization, there are suggestions that somewhere between 40 to 50% of 15 to 19 year olds in Europe are drinking, and about one in five, about 20% of them, think it's absolutely okay to get drunk once a week, which is quite scary. but maybe not so surprising to you. But I guess there's a very sort of simple foundational question. It's quite broad, but I wanted to ask it anyway. Can you give us a little bit of an insight as to what's going on in the 14 to sort of 15 year old mind and what sort of forces and dynamics there are at play, not just about alcohol, but in general, such that alcohol slots in?
And I think it's really important to understand teenage brain development if we're going to understand teenagers. And the adolescent phase of development, which really, it might start at about age 11, children are all different, it might not finish until early 20s, but the adolescent phase of development is really unique in terms of the brain. And we have to understand that because teenagers' brains and the way they think fundamentally different from adults and from younger children, from their previous selves, how they used to think. So the thing that happens in the adolescent years is the brain undergoes an upgrade. And the brain always does its development work from the back towards the front, because the back part of the brain is where the real survival mechanisms are that keep us alive, that keep us breathing, that keep us safe. And the front part of the brain is that lovely thinking, rational part of the brain that weighs up decisions, that plans, that organizes, all of the qualities that we associate with maturity in teenagers. But at about the age, you know, that mid-teen period especially, teenagers are stuck halfway through that development project. So the back part of their brain and the mid part, which are in control of emotions that respond to thrill and excitement and that are, you know, respond to risk, both in terms of being highly anxious about that, but also being highly drawn towards risk. That part of the brain is pumped up, fully primed, all ready to go. It is operating on 5G. Whereas the front part of the brain, that thinking, rational, planning, decision-making part of the brain, is still on 3G. It's not yet been wired up. So we get this kind of dropping out of their really thoughtful, rational side very often. And teens are really easily overwhelmed by emotion, by things like anxiety, by social pressure, that sense of threat. The people around them make them more drawn towards risk, to making poor decision making. And all of that impacts on decision making and mood, and indeed the way they treat us or listen to us as parents. So we've really got to think about when we're talking to teenagers, which part of their brain am I talking to right now? Because at certain times, we'll have the highly emotional, reactive, kind of impulsive teenager. And it might be 10 minutes later, they've calmed down and we've got that sweet, thoughtful, rational, I'm so sorry, Mum, I didn't mean to be rude version of our teenager. And they're the same person, but at that moment, a slightly different part of their brain is kind of in ascendancy. And that's really relevant when it comes to poor decision making around alcohol or any kind of risky behavior, but also decision making that involve their friendship groups.
Oh, my God. I mean, I love the 5G, 3G analogy. And I can very much relate to that whole pendulum swinging between, you know, a 13-year-old who, on the one hand, just wants a cuddle and, you know, to cuddle up close and have some mum time, and then is kind of slamming the door in my face 5 minutes later and shouting blue murder. Okay, so there's quite a lot going on there, because I guess what we're saying is they're not kids, or at least a large part of their brain is not kids. You know, we will look at I'm going to keep with this sort of the idea of my 13-year-old, because she is my youngest, you know, she's my baby. She doesn't see herself in that respect, or at least a significant part of her brain doesn't. And it's, I will have a hankering to sort of protect and keep her close and to draw everything in and together. And she is almost rallying against that with the idea of pushing away independence, experimenting, all those other things. And they're opposed forces, aren't they?
Oh, and the problem is, of course, as parents, we've spent the previous 10, 12, however many years learning to parent a slightly different child who had different drivers, who had like different mechanisms, different buttons. And suddenly we can find ourselves faced with a teenager who is pushing away, whose main developmental project is to become independent from us. So they're trying to separate, they're trying to move out into society, into their peer group. They've got very different things going on. And yet the tools that we're used to are around things like control, telling them what to do, being able to, you know, tell them this is the truth or not, and them listening to us. Whereas we're suddenly faced with a child who doesn't necessarily take what we say as wisdom, who certainly doesn't accept our control, who asserts their own right to make their own decisions, despite the fact that we think that they're making bad ones. And you can get a lot of conflict clearly in that situation, because a natural way to respond to that is to try and assert your control even more, because you feel disempowered, and that leads to a teenager trying to assert their independence even more, and the conflict escalates. And that, I think, you know, is where we don't want to be, whether it's around conversations with alcohol or any other behavior or issue. What we want is to be having those great conversations with their thinking brain, not in a moment of escalation and emotion, so that we've got the possibility to influence their thinking.
Okay, we are definitely going to come on and talk about how we do that. You know, so much of that makes sense, but of course it's often easier said than done, particularly when we know that we're talking about something around which we have fear, to be honest, don't we? It's we want to protect, and particularly on something like alcohol, we do have the benefit of wisdom and of hindsight, and we think that should go an awful long way. But of course it's how we sort of exert that influence that's going to be all important. So we'll talk about that. I just wanted to pull back a minute. When you're talking about, you know, the 14, 15 year old, and you know, the sort of the dynamics that they're going through, the forces, you were talking about fitting in and peer pressure and belonging and anxiety. When I coach people around alcohol adults, we always sort of talk about the jobs that we give alcohol to do. And it strikes me that it shouldn't surprise me when I think about it, but it strikes me that they are the same jobs, but it's just probably with bells on when it comes to particularly things like the fitting in, the peer pressure.
Yeah, so it's part of that kind of unique brain development that the adolescents go through. They are neurologically more alert to feeling threatened socially. So when we do MRI scans of the teenage brain and compare that to adults or younger children, a teenage brain will light up with the same intensity and in the same areas when they feel socially threatened. So they feel humiliated or like they're not fitting in or that they're being excluded. It will light up with the same intensity in those circumstances as when we compare that to physical pain in the adult or child brain. So they genuinely feel social pain much more greatly. Now that can mean that leads them to behaviors that will, you know, go along with peer pressure. So I don't want to be left out. So they might make decisions. They might give alcohol the job of making them look like they fit in. They might give alcohol the job of kind of making them feel more confident because they're worried about fitting in. They might withdraw to their bedrooms and have nothing to do with this because they're so anxious about fitting in. So although the kind of the brain development is similar, it follows the same pattern, teenagers respond to that in different ways. And that's why we need to be curious, because they also might be having such a hard time with stress or anxiety that they discover that alcohol takes away those intrusive thoughts or numbs their feelings. So there are lots of reasons why teenagers might drink. There are lots of jobs that they might give to alcohol. And if as parents we're going to support them, we have to be curious about which one it is, rather than assuming that it would have been for the reasons we thought it might be.
Yeah, and you've just used a really interesting word there. You said, you know, as parents, if we want to support them. And I think that's a fundamentally different sentiment and ambition than control them, manipulate them, lead them. What you're talking about there is really getting down to their level and understanding what it is that's going on with them, the things behind the drinking, if that's the route that they're going down.
If we don't do that, we don't know how to support them. So if they're drinking just because they're curious or they want confidence or they want to fit in, as parents, we need to respond to that in a very different way than if they're drinking to numb their feelings because they're really finding life tough at the moment. If we don't know which one it is, how can we support them? So it's really about, rather than thinking about disciplining teenagers in terms of controlling them, it's about trying to work with them to make good decisions, because we're not in that park when the vodka's being passed around. We're not there. They are. So we have to work with them. We have to collaborate with them so that they're equipped to make good decisions. And I think to me, that's the real goal of any kind of boundary setting or, you know, trying to respond to teenage behavior is supporting them to make good decisions. For that, we need to be curious.
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose it's just occurred to me as well, sort of pennies dropping as we go along here, that, you know, if children at sort of 13 and 14 and certainly 15 are already possibly in the park where the vodka is being passed around, we need to be having these conversations potentially around the age of 12, 13.
Well, most parents of teens, these things really sneak up on us and we don't really find out that we need to be talking about these things until after something happens and we realise our teenager has been doing something. And I think being able to have open conversations from a very young age about these things, you know, is really important.
But it's scary. It is scary, isn't it? Because you sort of sit there as a parent and you think, I want to be the one that has this conversation. I don't want it to be another 14-year-old who has this conversation, you know, with my daughter. I want to be the one who explains it or, you know, talks about the various risks attached, because that 14-year-old isn't going to, you know, the friend isn't going to. They're just going to be saying, have some. But it's scary because you also think to yourself, well, if it's not on their horizons yet, then I'm putting something onto their horizons that aren't really on their horizons. And am I therefore bringing it into their consciousness earlier than it needs to be? And you just have this sort of slight, oh, timing's everything kind of conversation.
Parents often worry that by bringing something up, they will make it happen. And none of the evidence supports that. All of the evidence says if we talk to children about risky behavior, whether that is, you know, having sex, you know, drinking alcohol, any of the kind of risks that they're likely to be facing, if we talk about those, they're less likely to do them. And I think we also make the mistake of thinking our job is to land a message with our young teenagers or, you know, or older children. Actually, conversations can be very curious things. They can be things in which we are asking their opinion. You know, if you've got a child who's right at the end of primary school, for example, you could have a very curious conversation about the fact that, oh, you know, I read in the paper the other day that children start drinking. Paul, is that something that any of your friends have done that's on you, you know, that's happened to you? Rather than jumping in with, oh my goodness, you mustn't do this. Actually, exploratory conversations, those are the best ones to be having rather than the, you know, they're always trying to deliver a message.
Yeah. And I suppose, I mean, that does a number of things as well, doesn't it? It treats them like an adult for a start. You know, I'm really interested in your opinion about these things. What's going on in your world? Have you seen it? This is something I've seen. Is it something you've seen? But also, you know, how do you feel about that? I read that this is happening. How do you feel about that? And I suppose that opens a very interesting conversation, not just about whether it's been on their radar at all, but the nub of it, really, how they feel about it and, you know, what it might mean for them.
And that question, what would you do if one of your friends was drinking? Or what would you do if you were offered alcohol? Because it might be that your child's already got a pretty clear sense of where they stand on these things. So rather than jumping in and us saying, this is what you should do, it's that collaborative, curious approach, which I think really leads us to a lot more influence and, you know, and a lot more understanding.
And I think that word influence, I mean, you mentioned support and I picked up on that, but I think in the absence of, you know, let's just agree from what's been said so far, we cannot control what our kids are doing. Painful as that is, we can't. So surely the goal following that, if it can't be controlled, it has to be, you know, the influence and to be able to exert positive influence where we can, and also just keep in check where we might not be necessarily modeling positive influence, or we might be modeling negative influence. But influence is the key, isn't it?
Yes, and influence comes down to relationship underpinning that, because we can't influence somebody unless we understand where they're coming from. So, you know, it is one of my mantras when it comes to teenagers and parenting, that relationship is more important than principle, because when you have a good relationship, you can at least try and guide them to, you know, to stay safe, to make good decisions. Whereas if you stand on principle and you're locked in conflict, you've got no voice other than, you know, they just will reject what you're saying. So really prioritizing relationship.
So I'm thinking, I'm sitting here and I'm thinking about, you know, the relationships that I really prize, you know, the relationships with my husband and the relationships I have with my sort of besties. And they are almost without exception based on, I suppose, respect and trust. A consistency. I kind of know what I'm going to get from them to a degree, although not always. But certainly, you know, yeah, I would say I go back, I suppose, respect and trust. They listen to me, I listen to them. And it's exactly the same, I suppose. It's exactly the same. I certainly don't feel I'm superior. I don't think I know more than they do. I don't try and exert my values onto them. Exactly the same principles would bear true with a teenager.
It would. And I think that the particular word there is about being non-judgmental, being accepting, because part of that teenage kind of neurological alertness to threat is that teens are very prone to take the advice that we give them as criticism. So if we even gently try and sort of give a piece of advice to a teenager that says, well, you should do this, that sets off that kind of social threat of not being respected, not being independent, and they're more likely to think, so you think I can't do it by myself. You're saying, you know, I can't make this decision. So we have to land so gently. Imagine them as your most sensitive friend, the one who really doesn't like being criticized, and listen to them in those ways and being really supportive, so that we are not trying to pass on wisdom, because that just doesn't work.
So I suppose the situation there might be, you know, if one of my daughters came home from school and said that, you know, something was being passed around, vodka was being passed around in the girls' toilets or something, and I was like, right, I am ringing the school, blah 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 blah, I'm straight away saying, you can't handle this, I don't trust you in that situation. Or at least, although I'm not saying it, that's possibly what her super sensitive mind, she could be telling me something because I have a good relationship and I've invited her to talk to me about stuff. But my emotional response is in stark contradiction to the sort of the safety that I've suggested that she can talk to me whenever she wants to.
And that's it. We have to learn to control ourselves when we're talking to teens. Quite often the teenagers are scary.
Oh, God.
When you're a parent, it's so scary. There are so many risks. You know, it feels like the stakes are so high. And as a parent, we therefore get triggered. All our alarm bells go off when they tell us something like that. And we have to just tune those out and go, okay, I'm feeling slightly worried by what they're saying. I'm going to hold that thought, hold that feeling, and I'll explore that a little bit later. Right now, I'm just going to listen in a non-judgmental way, because sometimes when we do that and we just say, what happened then? Tell me more about that. You know, and we explore it in that curious way with them, we might well find out that actually one of the girls did go and tell the teacher about it, and that they resolved it among themselves, that they've got a plan and that they implemented it. And then, you know, if we've only listened to our alarm bells, we haven't really had that conversation and understood the full context of what happened. So we have to tune out our reactions a little bit or hold them till later.
That's quite hard, yes. Isn't it?
Yes, it's very hard. You do get better with practice. That's the one thing I would say, is the more you do it as the parent of a teenager, the better you get at it. You still fall off the wagon and, you know, you just kind of go straight into shout mode, you know, and you find yourself doing that. And you think, oh, no, I shouldn't have done that. It's okay. We just go back and we apologise and we repair. But the more you do it, you know, the better you get at it.
I'm actually just reminded of something when I'm coaching people and they talk about having an alcohol craving. I always say to them, there are very few things in life that you have to respond to immediately. And actually to literally just pause and take a second and consider, you know, what your response would be. In the example I'm giving, that's obviously, do I really need a drink and is it really going to help me? But in the situation with guarding teenagers, it's just like, take a deep breath, maybe turn away, walk away, do something for a few minutes, and then come back and reopen that conversation on a more emotional, even keel, rather than the where you may have gone in the instant, in the moment.
What we want to do is we want to remain in our thinking rational brain. We want two thinking rational brains talking to each other, not two triggered emotional kind of fight or flight amygdala talking to each other. That's not what we need. Those conversations do not go well.
No, I can vouch for the fact that those conversations do not go well. Okay, can I just quickly ask you about being vulnerable as a parent, in build, you know, the role of vulnerability, if you like, in building that trust? So sharing our own stories and experiences. So for example, I mean, my background is I got myself into a real problem place with drinking. Because I'm very open about talking about that now. I have talked about that with my kids. But sometimes we do feel, don't we, like we have to have it all figured out. You know, we can sort of be nervous about having a conversation because we're not perfect ourselves, and that can sort of stop us having a conversation. We can feel vulnerable about it, and I wondered whether, well, I'm guessing that vulnerability is quite a key part of building trust.
Yeah, I think when it comes to sharing your own experiences as a parent, there are pros and cons to that with teenagers. One of them is about that really being open and honest and vulnerable and saying, you know, this is me, this is why I'm reacting like this. And sometimes we can explain our reaction by saying, the reason I get triggered by this, the reason I find this such a hard issue is because of my own experiences. This isn't your fault. This is actually about me. And this is, and teens can really respond to that. When we own something as our issue, then they don't feel like we're blaming them or judging them. And that can be really helpful. On the other hand, we can sometimes hijack conversations and not actually listen to their experiences because of our own, you know, our own experience. So we might say, oh yeah, but I did that and this is what happened. And they're like, but this is me. You're not listening to me. This is about me. So I think you have to be just mindful and careful about the way that you use your own experiences when you're talking to teenagers, that we do so in a way that helps them, that you're owning it as yours, not saying this will definitely happen to you. And I think when we can do that carefully, teenagers really respect that and understand it. And they will be quite gentle with us in response to that. When we're heavy-handed with it, they will be heavy-handed back.
Yeah, sure. Okay, that makes sense. So it's a sort of yes, share your own mistakes and obviously, you know, the benefit of wisdom, the benefit of hindsight, but make sure that it's very clear that they are your mistakes and that you're not necessarily transposing those onto, you know, the child, or suggesting that they're going to make exactly the same mistakes.
Yeah. Anything that threatens their independence is not going to be kind of very helpful. It's about being respectful.
Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons why I do talk to particularly my eldest, who's 16, she probably knows a little bit more about my background than my youngest does. But I've kind of assumed that I'm doing her a bit of a disservice if I don't share. You know, if I do have the benefit of experience and I'm not sharing that, then I'm not really giving her a chance to sort of evolve past me or learn from my mistakes. Is there a sort of a you're looking as if there's a tension here,
there
isn't
is,
there?
Because teenagers have to learn through their own experiences and their own mistakes. So that fundamental desire that we can somehow inoculate them from our mistakes by telling them about them, I think really we have to focus and center on them and what they're going through. So yes, being able to share and say, this is what happened to me, this was my experience, but not really to expect that that will then be something that they will say, oh, well, that happened to my mum, to my dad, so therefore I'm not going to do it. They will go ahead and make their own mistakes and learn through their own experiences. We have to be prepared for that, because that's what we did. Our wisdom and our knowledge came from our experiences. We didn't accept it from other people.
That is so true. It's so true when you think about that. Yeah, no, I get that. So distilling some of this down, I'm thinking, you know, be led by their questions, be led by their conversations, keep talking, keep it open, and ask them how they feel. So, you know, their emotions and their thoughts and feelings are absolutely key. And then I suppose from the delivery of particular messages around alcohol, it's not necessarily about our mistakes and what we did. There's a strong argument from what you're saying, Anita, about keeping the sort of the messages around alcohol quite factual.
Keeping it factual, yes. I think facts are usually helpful, but basing it on what's really going on for them. So, for example, let's say you've got a teenager, you've had a conversation with them, and really what's emerged from that is that they are, you know, using alcohol, or it might be that they're using weed or some other kind of substance, because they're finding things difficult. They're finding it hard to manage their thoughts and feelings. So from that conversation, you're probably going to go to the point that says, okay, it's really understandable that you're doing that, and I understand why that's a really tempting and useful thing to do. However, these are the facts about how that is harmful to you, potentially. Is there another mechanism that we could explore, that you could explore, to achieve the same thing that would be less harmful? Or it could be a conversation that says, actually, so you ended up drinking because you felt like you were backed into a corner, you would have looked silly if you hadn't to your mates. I get that. Totally understand that. That might happen again. What could you do next time that would be a different course of action? Because we know that drinking, especially when you're 13 or 14, is really not a good idea. So I think it's about basing it on that, why they got themselves into that situation, if that's what we're talking about, giving them the facts as to why that's probably not the best option, although we're always accepting and understanding as to why they made that choice, and then thinking about how can we help them to make a different choice next time. So it's all about trying to kind of support them to make good decisions, rather than telling them, you know, assuming that they've done things or telling them what to do. And that's a collaborative thing, I think.
Yeah, so it's exploring together, as you say, the other things, other tools.
Exactly.
Yeah. What I've talked about with my 16-year-old is, you know, I have kept things factual, and I've made things quite stark as well, to be honest. You know, not because I want to scare the living bejesus out of her, but the sort of, well, for example, young people are at risk from alcohol. There's no doubt about it. Alcohol poisoning is very dangerous. You don't hear about it all the time because it's actually so frequent. It doesn't make the news. It's just, you know, a thing to watch out for. You know, there are other dangers and risks involved, particularly, I'm, as I say, mother of daughters, accidents, injuries, unwanted sexual advances, fights, muggings, that kind of thing. You know, I also, and this is a sort of a softer thing, I have had that conversation where in the long run, you know, it doesn't make you happy. There are strong links to mental health issues. And I've also talked to her as well, because she's quite strident in her views about things. I've sort of pointed out that we're kind of being mugged off. You know, the alcohol industry is marketing like mad to her, and wanting to get her on into the drinking game. So, you know, what stance does she want to take on that? But those are the kind of things that I have said by way of purely pointing out these are some of the risks, some of the messages I wanted to land. I don't know if I've done the right thing, but I think that's, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think especially talking about behavior that goes with alcohol, because one of the biggest risks is that poor decision making, that walking home on their own, that, you know, crossing the road without thinking about it. The, you know, there's definitely a link between alcohol use and other risky behaviors like unprotected sex, for example. So being really honest about what the risks are, and also that, you know, in terms of their brain is still developing, their bodies, their vital organs are still developing, and alcohol impacts children, and the younger they are, the more so, really fundamentally on that physiological level. So that is something that will, you know, will stay with them. For example, you know, poor mental health, you're absolutely right. But we also have to acknowledge that although we have the facts and we give them, that doesn't mean to say teenagers are very likely to turn around and say, yeah, but that won't happen to me. That won't happen to me. Because the way they evaluate risk is very different from the way adults evaluate risk. So when you and I are weighing things up, we look at the probability of something happening and the impact. And if there is a catastrophic impact, even if it's really low probability, adults tend to go, well, I won't do that, because if it did go wrong, it would be awful. However, teenagers tend to evaluate risk differently. They look more at probability. So if there's a catastrophic impact that we've told them about, but it's a really low probability, then they go, yeah, but that's not going to happen to me. The chances of that are really small, so I don't have to worry about it, and I'll go ahead and do it anyway. So they're more predisposed to risk taking as a result of that. So the facts themselves often have to be accompanied by advice around, and if your teenager is drinking and they are going and drinking despite all of that, really messages around, okay, know what you're drinking. Don't just take something that somebody passes you. Think about safety. What are the precautions that you can take to make sure that you stay safe and that you drink in moderation, that you're, you know, that you're, and without condoning it, being able to say, number one, I don't want you to drink. This is my advice. However, I'm not the person in that situation. And if you decide to do so, which I hope you don't, these are the things that I'd like you to really think about, you know, and being really supportive about their safety as much as anything else.
I think that's, 100%. And just for the benefit of sort of listeners here as well, for the record, the things that I have pointed out as far as that safety is concerned is avoid spirits, because at the age of, certainly at the age of 14, 15, we have not developed a real sense of how to regulate a dosage of alcohol. And these are clearly the strongest. Don't mix it with drugs. I mean, you mentioned weed and stuff like that, you know, but just don't, because that's an unholy cocktail that they're not yet, you know, necessarily physiologically built to cope with. Stay with your friends. Help your friends. If you see friends in trouble, don't get into cars with friends who might be a bit older than you and who you've been drinking with. Don't post and message. Certainly don't post and message parts of your body that no one ever needs to see, which is a thing. Just be aware, just be alert and look out for each other, really. Some of the things that I would say to her.
Definitely, you know, and moderation, you know, dilute it. Often, you know, bottles get passed around in the park that have been pre-mixed, you know, whether it's vodka and some kind of soft drink, and they have no idea what the proportions are. So really, actually, go very, very slowly. Have a sip and wait, you know, really space things out, and, you know, don't kind of drink quickly. And, you know, we can say these things, they might have to get it wrong to learn it. And that's the difficult situation, you know, that as many of us had to, you know, get things wrong in order to learn. But it is important. I think the issue around adults or parents not giving children alcohol, I think, is a really big one, because parents take different views on that. Some parents will say, well, I don't want them drinking vodka, therefore I'll give them a 4 cans of wheat lager or something. The evidence really doesn't support that as a preventative approach, because the key factor there is the amount that they drink. The amount that they drink at an earlier age is directly related to the higher the risk of poor outcomes as a result of alcohol-related harm in any way. So where it comes from is not really the issue, it's quantity. And if we're giving them alcohol, they could still also be getting it from their friends. I don't think that sends a signal that's very clear. And teens need real clarity and consistency. If we're going to say don't do it, then we don't give them booze. We can still talk about, you know, what they should do if they find themselves in that situation, but I don't think it's helpful to actually be giving it to them.
No, I'm really glad that you brought that up, because I did want to mention that quickly, because I think there's a few things, isn't there? There's the show not tell principle, that we know that our kids are going to emulate what we do more than what we say. So on the one hand, if we're saying, you know, moderate or little amounts or whatever, but then we're chugging a bottle of wine at home, or they can see the empties piling up on a nightly basis, our message is slightly contradictory there between take it slowly, but I can drink as much as I want. And I think this idea of, I mean, I talked about it earlier, is how liberal should we be as parents? I did want to ask you this, because there's a strong line of thought, isn't there, that if we do introduce it with those weak alco pops, then we're steering them away from hard stuff, but we're also somehow dosing it, doing it in a controlled way, which means that they won't go off the rails and do things in an uncontrolled way. And what you're saying is there isn't really any evidence to suggest that that would be the case.
No, there isn't. And certainly the NHS recommends, you know, and many health organisations recommend a completely alcohol-free childhood up to the age, certainly the NHS says 18. The only thing they do say is if children are going to drink, it definitely shouldn't be under 15. It should only be in a supervised setting, so that's with a parent, and no more than one drink a week. Now, none of that squares with us, you know, arming them with 4 week cans of lager to go to a party. You don't have to do those things. And the correlation is between no or very, very small amounts of alcohol is the lowest risk. And the more they drink, regardless of source, then the higher the risk. I also think that teenagers are the first people to call us hypocrites. You know, they really will call you if they feel like you're being hypocritical. So you do have to be really clear in your messaging. And that boundary setting, although we're collaborating with teens to be supportive and to help them make good decisions, there are certain decisions we do control. We control whether they have alcohol in our house. We control whether we give them alcohol. Those things we can control. And I think those things we probably should control. Now, you know, if you've got a 17-year-old and you're thinking, actually, maybe if I, you know, have a pint with them and introduce them to the idea, I'm not saying that's the worst thing you can do as a parent. But in terms of a principle, really sticking to our guns and saying, well, that bit I control and that bit I'm not going to do, I'm not going to give it to you, and I'm going to try and be a good role model.
And I'm just going to throw a couple of things in there just to sort of back up and support what you've said. One of them you mentioned earlier, the advice, as you say, from the NHS, it's actually the UK Chief Medical Officer's advice, is that children under the age of 15 should not be drinking at all. And that's not from a moral standpoint. That is from the perspective that at that age, their bones, their hormones, their brain, many of their organs are still developing. And we know that alcohol interrupts and generally, technical term, but kind of buggers up a lot of the body's kind of natural processes and natural function. So introducing alcohol at that age is not helpful in any shape or form to the developing child.
There's no evidence that it is at all helpful. And I think there's another issue here around parents sort of providing alcohol. And that is, although teenagers might say they don't care what we think, that they, you know, that they don't listen to us, our approval or disapproval really does matter to them. And when we look at other behaviours, other health habits, for example, what we see is that although teens might experiment with doing things differently, so, you know, they might have had a really good role model of healthy eating in reason, not kind of militant, as they grew up, and generally they watch us and we're eating vegetables and etc. Yes, in their teenage years, they might do fast food, crisps and chocolate and a lot of it. They tend to come back to the behaviours that were role modelled to them within their family. So it really matters what we model to them. And therefore, you know, that bit I think we can control, and we can say, actually, you know, I'm not going to add fuel to the fire that's already there pulling you towards these risks.
That's a very good point. And I also, to that, I would also add that we're talking about this on the podcast a couple of episodes ago, actually. Drinking is actually an acquired taste. You know, when you're very young and you first drink alcohol, your gag reflex, you know, every part of your body is saying, spit it out. But because we want to drink and we want to be in the drinking game, we persevere, and it is very much an acquired taste. And I suppose, you know, the conversation that I was having with my husband the other day, for example, was it just goes to follow that the earlier you introduce alcohol into a child's body, to the child's palate, you are starting that process of taste acquisition. You're literally starting that whole, come on, you'll get used to this, which is physiologically true as well as emotionally true. So it's a sort of, it really jars with me, the sort of, but probably unsurprisingly, given where I come from, the sort of, you know, introducing alcohol in your own home, I'm kind of a bit down on that. But it's funny because I have debates with my husband, and that's the other side of parenting, isn't it? Alignment. Alignment and consistency. We won't go there though. It's like a whole new conversation.
Parenting's an act of judgment. We all have to just do our best in the situation that we're in to make the best judgment we can. It's not really about rights and wrongs. And as somebody who's speaking from, all I'm saying is this is what the evidence is, you know, in terms of what we know from research. Research is often incomplete as well. And that relationship between you and your child should probably guide, you know, what you do. But it is about just reaching your best decision, either as, you know, two parents together or by yourself, that this is where I stand, and sitting comfortably in that. Even if our teenagers, you know, shout at us and, you know, are annoyed with us because every other parent is letting, you know, them have alcohol at their party or whatever, just being comfortable and saying, well, okay, that might be the truth, but this is my decision and it's my decision to make, and that's okay.
And I think that is the difference, isn't it, between wanting to, you know, be your child's best friend versus parenting.
We have to be prepared to be unpopular and make decisions that we've made that children, that teenagers don't particularly like, and sit comfortably in those. We aren't going to be liked by them all the time. We could give them everything that they want and they still would shout at us and not like our decisions. So we might as well draw those lines and in places that we've thought about and that we feel comfortable with.
There were a couple of other things I wanted to talk about, one of which I can pop as some resource is actually just advice on safe parties, etc. I can pop that into resources on my website. So whilst I have you, literally the last couple of minutes, could I just quickly ask you, when it's all gone a bit wrong and your teenager has kind of absented themselves, you think they're hanging out with mates, probably drinking, you know, they've nailed closed their bedroom door and you are not welcome, what can we try and do if we are worried sick that they are now locked into a very unhealthy place?
Really going for that mantra that relationship is the important thing. So build it. Now, you might have to build it through tiny little micro bridges. But if every time you pass your teen on the stairs or they come down to raid the fridge or whatever, you jump on that moment to try and land a message or have a go at them or tell them that you're worried about them, they are going to learn to avoid you more and more. So sometimes if we're going to focus on relationship, we need to park that a little bit and we need to allow them to come in and, you know, and go into the fridge and have a little joke with them, smile at them, signal our approval of them. One of the reasons they might be avoiding you is because they know how much you disapprove, and that's fundamentally difficult for them because that underpins how they feel about themselves. So we have to do little micro bridges of, I'm here, I like you, I'm kind of like, I'm positive about you, and try and build on those little moments. And rather than, you know, popping into their bedroom to have a moan at them about this, that, or the other, pop into their bedroom with, I don't know, a nice fruit smoothie that you've made and say, oh, I made this for you. I thought you could do with something healthy. Leave it there. It might not get drunk. What they'll read from that is you care about them. You care about their well-being and that you love them. And those are really important tiny messages. Well, they're tiny gestures with big messages behind them that we want to land. So rather than thinking, how do I find a route to tell them what they're doing wrong? Think about, how do I find a route to tell them I love them, I care about them? And from that, maybe we can grow the opportunity for other conversations that leads to you owning your worries and saying, you know what? I know that I don't get to see what you do. And I know I'm your mum, and therefore I worry. I worry about all these things. I really do worry about that. And sometimes that affects the way I behave, but I do it because I love you a lot. So start there, then grow towards the other conversations. That would be my advice.
No, that's great. Thank you. It's an extension of the keep them talking, isn't it? It's just make sure that those conversations don't close down altogether, even if that talking is through those small gestures. Oh my God, it's hard, isn't it? Parenting.
And teenagers especially, I mean, I know toddlers are hard, but teens can be, when it goes wrong, it feels so catastrophic, and we can feel so out of kilter because of that. We can feel so threatened ourselves by, you know, the things that are threatening them, and it can be quite overwhelming. And I would say, please don't judge other parents. If you've got a lovely teenager who doesn't drink, one of those great ones who's taking all the smart routes and choices through life and excelling and being great, don't judge the parents, the ones who are going the rocky route, because it's not that they haven't given the right advice. It's just that teenagers do that, and they actually deserve your support, not your judgment. You know, we are all trying to do our best here, and the chances are they will come back and they will kind of be turned into lovely, beautiful young people who make smart decisions. We've just got to hold on and maintain relationship with them in the meantime. So don't judge yourself and don't judge others.
That's a lovely message to finish on. I will pop a few bits and pieces into the free resources on my website around, you know, teenage parties and stuff like that. But that conversation has been brilliant. Thank you. I've learned so much myself. So I've no doubt it's been of huge, huge benefit to the Big Drink Rethink listeners as well. So thank you so much for coming on, Anita. I really do value it.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, Anna.
Thank you for listening and getting curious. Please rate, review, and follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you're choosing to listen. And don't forget to tune in to the next episode. And you can find out more about the Big Drink Rethink by heading to my website, thebeliefscoach.com. That's thebeliefs, BELIEFS coach.com, where you will see clear links to the show.